Welcome, I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death for Americans. According to the latest figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2013, more than 41,000 people committed suicide in the United States, and that means a suicide death every 12.8 minutes. So today on the show, what are the most effective ways to prevent suicide? San Francisco has decided to build a barrier to suicide by installing a $76 million stainless steel net under the Golden Gate Bridge, which is the world's leading suicide hotspot. Over 1,600 people have leapt to their deaths from the bridge since it was constructed back in 1937. But does imposing barriers to suicide stop desperate people from taking their lives? And more fundamentally, what drives people to commit suicide, and what does it take to prevent it from happening? Kevin Hines is a mental health and suicide prevention advocate and the author of Cracked, Not Broken: Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. On September 24th, 2000, at the age of 19, Kevin, who is bipolar, attempted to take his life by jumping off the bridge. He fell 220 feet straight down into the bay, shattering his T12, L1, and L2 vertebrae and lacerating his lower organs. A Coast Guard boat pulled Kevin from the frigid waters and brought him to San Francisco General Hospital. Kevin is currently producing a documentary about the ripple effect of suicide, and it highlights the Golden Gate Bridge. And Kevin joins us on the phone. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hi, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you for being with us. And we're also joined on the phone from New York by Dr. Jill Harkavy-Friedman. She is a psychologist and vice president of research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And here in studio, we're joined by Courtney Brown. She is the hotline coordinator for the San Francisco Suicide Prevention Hotline. Hey, Courtney, thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Friedman, we'll start with you. More than 41,000 people commit suicide in the U.S. every year. That's based on that 2013 report from the CDC. How accurate is this figure? Because some people say if suicide was not a cultural taboo, we would have seen much higher numbers.
Well, actually, the number probably is higher than 41,149 because sometimes suicides go unreported. And in addition, either they go unreported because they're not documented or because they're misclassified as accidental deaths.
Mm-hmm.
The taboo is not about talking about it. It's about trying not to die by suicide.
Mm. And just a correction, the Golden Gate Bridge is the second most used suicide bridge in the world after the Nanjing Yangtze River Bridge in China. So, Dr. Friedman, what do you think about stigma as a barrier to suicide prevention?
Well, the suicide rates have been going up, and the stigma remains. The stigma is really about getting mental health care. And if we can reduce that stigma, then we're likely to see a reduction in suicide.
There's still a stigma to getting mental health care today.
Yes. You know, we conducted a Harris poll with the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and the Action Alliance, and we found that 94% of people actually realize now that suicide is preventable. And almost half of people felt that at some time they might have had a mental health problem, but there's still a reluctance to get help.
And that reluctance stems from what? Shame, or what is it?
Well, that's a good question. Part of it comes from when you're not feeling well mentally, you don't really feel like other people can help you or there's anything available. So part of it is just educating people that we do have very effective treatments available, whether it's psychotherapy, group therapy, or medication, and often the combination. So one is just not knowing that you have something where you can get some help. Some is lack of support from family members and friends to go ahead and get that help. And we find that people want to help people, but they don't necessarily know that they can.
And so once they know there are these services, is it the case that people do seek that help?
That's the hope. Now, the other part is that we don't have the services available as available as we would like them to be. So even people who want to help can't always access it. So there are many factors that are coming together all at once. But the stigma or the feeling that it's not okay to have a mental health condition is really starting to wane, because people see that when you take care of your mental health, like you do your physical health, you can have a very solid and positive life. And with that available, the stigma will go away.
And so one of those tools is a suicide hotline. And with us here is Courtney Brown. So, Courtney, how is it employed right now, the hotline here in San Francisco?
So our hotline in San Francisco is available 24 hours a day to whoever calls in. And it's used very, very frequently. We get between 150 to 200 calls per day. And we don't require people to be suicidal when they call, which reflects what you were saying earlier, that it's important that people have mental health care before they're in a crisis. We want people to call when they're feeling really low, when they're feeling like nothing in the world can help them, that there's somebody out there that they can talk to help them feel a little less alone. And hopefully that will prevent the suicidal ideation from forming.
When people make that call, why do they tell you they're making that call? Or what drove them to say, I'm going to pick up the phone and make this call?
We usually consider it an act of ambivalence. So there is definitely a part of them that wants to die. Even the people who say that they're not actively considering taking their own life today, there is still that desire to not be here anymore. There's still that pain. But first, we allow them to express all of that pain, and don't look for the silver lining, their brighter side right away. We allow things to be really dark and really bleak. And then as soon as people express all of that, you can start hearing these shreds of ties to life more and more throughout the call. Then we start focusing on those, whether it's other people in their life. Maybe they are completely isolated and alone. Very frequently, we'll have people that have a pet, and we end up spending the entire call talking about how they're staying alive for their pet, or they're staying alive for some passion or some dream. And many people will just continue staying alive because the act of survival is brave, and we will encourage them to see that in themselves.
And Dr. Friedman was talking about letting people know about these kinds of services. So how are you letting people know about this hotline?
Yeah, we frequently have advertising campaigns in the Muni stations and the BART stations. One of the most frequent ways that people find out about the suicide hotline is that we're part of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Routing Network. So there's a phone number that's really commonly advertised. It's the 273-8255 number. And that will route whoever is calling it to the closest suicide prevention agency to their area code. So the majority of our new callers, people who are just finding out about it, seem to come through that network that's advertised on TV and other places.
Mm. And we are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can send your comments and suggestions to feedback or questions for our guests at feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you are someone who is coping with this, or you know a friend or a relative who's had an experience, or you're ask for help right now, we've got it for you right here, 866-798-8255. And so, Kevin, you did try to take your life in 2000 by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, and you survived. First of all, what made you take such a drastic measure to end your life at such a young age of 19?
Well, you know, it was a myriad of things, but it really was my brain. I had been living with bipolar disorder for 2.5 years prior to then. I was diagnosed at 17 and a half. I'm adopted, but both of my biological parents had the same brain disease I had, or I have. And I was brought to that bridge by voices in my head, seemingly not of my conscience, screaming in my head, "You have to die, jump now." I was brought to that bridge because of hearing voices and seeing things that didn't exist to anyone but me. I was brought to that bridge because of all of my symptoms, including extreme paranoia, immense, immeasurable depression, and manic behavior leading me to do things that I otherwise wouldn't do. I actually tell people that I never wanted to die by suicide. I believed I had to. I felt compelled to do nothing but take my life at 19. I was a baby. And I realized, and I recognized the mistake I made. Upon the millisecond my hands left that rail, I had what is called an instant regret, which, frankly, a great many people who survive their attempts actually have. Of the 34 people that have survived the fall off the Golden Gate Bridge, I'm number 26. 19 have come forward and said almost the same thing. The second they left that rail, they realized it was too late. They realized it was a mistake, but that it might have been too late. And the reality, I have to tell you something, is that I talked to the Marine coroner, the former Marine coroner, Ken Holmes, and I talked to the Coast Guard officers that pulled me from the bay that day, and they will tell you that when the Golden Gate Bridge District claimed that 46, the highest number ever, died off the bridge in the year 2014, they'll tell you that in the year 2000, when I went in the water that day, they had already seen 56 people dead off that bridge. So those numbers are sorely inaccurate, and I would wager to say that the Golden Gate Bridge is actually the highest spot for suicides in the world because of all of the people that are never found, all of the people washed away to sea, literally eaten by fish to the bone. I mean, you have no idea. It's a terrible way to die and often very slow and horrifying. I survived because I believe it's a miracle, and you know, today I travel the country and the globe talking about my experience to people who are suffering right then and there. And we share hope because we know that hope helps heal. We know that lived experience helps people change their lives. And we know that why we're doing this film, Suicide the Ripple Effect, is just for that reason, to show the power of hopeful stories that help people find recovery, stay in it, and stay alive.
And that's a film you are directing and producing and making. That's Kevin Hines, who is a mental health and suicide prevention advocate and author of Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. He attempted suicide from the Golden Gate Bridge in 2000. And we are going to go to your calls. The number to give us a call is 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255 if you have a question for one of our guests today or if you have an experience you'd like to share. So let's go to our first caller, Rosalie. Welcome to your call. Oh, John, sorry. Let's go. Your call.
Oh, yes, hi. This is John. I really do appreciate the show, and I appreciate you having Kevin Hines on. I think that there is probably no better advocate for a suicide barrier on the bridge than Kevin is. My 17-year-old daughter Casey jumped off the bridge in 2008 and disappeared. And for obvious reasons, I got involved in the fight for a suicide barrier. And I appreciate everything that has been that has come about since then to raise awareness for suicide and begin a dialogue and start talking about it. But there still seems to be a doubt about whether or not money spent on an actual net on the bridge is a waste of money. And nothing could be further from the truth. Because oftentimes, as Kevin well knows, and as he expressed very well, suicide is impulsive. And if there is something there to prevent you from accessing the means to suicide, chances are pretty good that you'll survive. It's not perfect, but if it increases the chance that your child or your loved one will live by a little bit, I'm sorry, $70 million plus is well worth the expense.
Okay, thank you, John. Again, our number is 866-798-TALK if you'd like to join the conversation. So this net is going to cost $76 million, as we just heard, about 4 years to complete. It is stainless steel, and the idea is that if you fall, you will be injured as if you fell from the second floor of a building. So lots of injuries, but you will not die, and that is the idea. So this debate over whether to make the suicide barrier or not is, you know, it's been over. It was voted for last year. What kind of conversations, Courtney, are you hearing around the barrier? And are people, you know, are many people still against it?
Yeah, a lot of people are still against it. The thing that I hear the most is people saying, well, if we take away this one means, someone's just going to attempt a different way. And that's definitely not true. People tend to fixate on one method, and especially the more accessible one method is, and the more that there's a cultural script for that method encouraging it. I mean, jumping from the bridge has this cultural significance of being this sort of beautiful poetic act, and it really isn't. And if we take that away from people, people who fixated on that as a way out, they are less likely to use a more violent and unappealing means. People are less likely, if they're fixating on jumping from the bridge, they're much less likely to jump from a building because, you know, there's this expectation of my body will become, you know, a public nuisance or something like that. People don't want to be found by their loved ones. The bridge is a space where if somebody jumps, they don't expect to be found, so they don't feel like they'll be burdening someone else. So this is a really, really unusual spot where people might attempt suicide, and many people who are considering suicide by that method would not consider any other method. So it will be protecting a lot of people.
Mm. And just to be clear, I never considered any other method. This is Kevin. I never considered any other method. I was fearful of all of the rest. I went to the Golden Gate Bridge simply because it was easy. It's a 4-foot rail, and it's ease of access to lethal means. And that's one way we know saves lives from suicide, reducing access to lethal means.
Hmm. Dr. Friedman, yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say that we know from research of several, well, first of all, there's the issue of any means, that if you can limit access to lethal means, you will reduce the rate of suicide. For the bridges, it seems to go down about 40%, and there have been several studies now that have shown that if you put a barrier, you may even get the same number of people going there. But in fact, what you gain is time to have somebody come in, intervene, and save that person's life. Because as was mentioned earlier, it is always an ambivalent act, and the will to live is very strong. And even in that moment, there's still some will to live. So having a barrier definitely reduces the rate. At the same time, they've shown that there's no increase in rate at other nearby bridges. And that has to do with what Kevin and John mentioned about being, sometimes it's more in the moment. And what happens is that your brain thinks, this is what I need to do. And you don't actually have access to other problem-solving skills or thoughts in that moment. You get a kind of tunnel vision, as if this is the one thing I have to do. So time becomes very, very important.
Dr. Friedman, what do you say to people who say this money is better spent in mental health services and mental health care that will prevent these people from going to the bridge in the first place?
Those funds can't go to anything but highway and transportation issues. They can't go to mental health.
So this comes from legislation that, just as Kevin is saying, is for highway and transportation. So it's not like this money is going to go someplace else. We need funds for mental health services as well. But I think that we cannot underestimate the value of one life. I mean, look at what Kevin has done since the time at which he almost died by suicide. He has saved thousands of lives just by doing what he's doing and by taking care of himself and his bipolar disorder. In addition, it's expensive. You have a lot of costs that go along with when somebody dies by suicide. And so we can't underestimate the value of one life, but it is an expensive thing. That money will be well worth the investment.
Okay, so we're going to go to another caller. If you'd like to give us a call, 866-798-TALK, or send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Eve in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call. Hi, Eve. Eve, are you there? Okay, maybe she can come back. Kevin, so what about after you kind of came back and started recovering? What was your recovery like, and what kind of support did you find?
You know, I was in the first hospital, Marine General, actually, for 4 weeks, going from a wheelchair to a walker and a back brace to a back brace and a cane, and then straight into a psychiatric hospital, the first of many for me. I didn't just get better after this thing. It has been a very long and rough road. 7 psych wards in less than 11 years. Places I had to go to because I had suicidal ideation. I live with chronic suicidal thoughts. They plague me enough, but I know how to fight them today and how to utilize help and tools around me, and that is my family, my faith, and my friends. I've opted in people in my life because I know I can't fight bipolar disorder and the trouble it brings me and my family by myself. My wife is my greatest advocate. My father is right by my side when I'm struggling. And here's what I do. I tell them the truth. Suffering mentally, going through these battles, I used to be in denial. I used to be filled with shame for what I was having going on. And I used to think they were just going to lock me up and throw away the key, and I'd never get out of a place like that. Well, I have fought long and hard alongside my family and friends. Not everybody has that close family and friends to help them. I've been lucky and blessed to have that. But it's been tough, you know. After my third psych ward stay, I finally said to myself, after some encouragement by my family, that the only person that can change the outcome of my reality is me by taking full responsibility of having bipolar disorder. I am not bipolar disorder. I have it. It's a part of me. I'm Kevin Hines, and I'm going to fight it every day with my friends and family and build this support network. And I have a mental health emergency plan. When I can't see myself, when I'm not self-aware enough to see that I'm struggling and having symptoms, I call upon these people.
And what about, Kevin, what about the people you're helping? What kind of support networks do they have? And how do you convince them? Or what is your approach to talking to them?
You know what? It's amazing what just pure honesty can do. Telling people you don't know from Adam everything about your struggle and how you survived and how you utilize a 10-step plan filled with things like therapy, education to your mental illness or behavioral health challenge, exercise, good sleeping habits, all of these things and so much more, eating healthily every day to feed your brain good, healthy food, all of these things can not only de-stress a person who doesn't have a mental struggle, but they can help somebody else heal who does. And I talk about all of those things in my presentation while telling them a very, very personal, heartfelt story about this pain that I've been through. And people come up to me from all over the world, and they say a couple of things. They say, I have this brain disease, but my family doesn't believe it's real. The next thing I hear the most is, I have this brain disease. I was going to take my life today, and now I am not. I'm going to ask for help. And we give them resources right then and there that are available to anyone.
And Courtney, and when someone calls and says, I'm done, I'm finished, what is the first thing you say?
Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, there's, I think, an impetus to say, I'm so sorry to hear that, but we really want to encourage people to think that they should reach out, and that when they do reach out, that they'll be rewarded for it with an open ear. We want to hear whatever is going on with them, no matter how bleak it is.
Again, that number is 866-798-TALK if you'd like to join our conversation about suicide prevention. We're going to be talking about the costs of mental health. Is mental health funded well here in the city, in California, in the country, really? Is it enough, and what is being done about it? And we're talking about the new net going up under the Golden Gate Bridge to prevent suicide. All that. Give us a call, 866-798-TALK, and also you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org or connect with us on Facebook as well. And we're going to be taking a short break, and we'll be back with more on Your Call.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. Once again, the toll-free number, if you'd like to join today's conversation, is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you would prefer to write your question or comment, you can send it to feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, Backstory. And then this afternoon at 1, Alternative Radio here on KALW San Francisco. We'll be right back.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hannah Baba sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking with nutrition scholar Marion Nessel about her new book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. But today, we're talking about suicide prevention and plans to build suicide deterrent net under the Golden Gate Bridge. With us is Kevin Hines and Dr. Jill Friedman and Courtney Brown. We're all here, and we are taking your calls, 866-798-TALK. Feedback at yourcallradio.org is the email. Let's go straight to your calls. Let's go to Donek. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to say hello. Thank you also to Kevin, particularly for his own personal story. I came through a psychotic attack quite a number of years ago, and where suicide reared its head. I can't say that I wanted to take suicide, but that it was... Because I was thinking so fast, I was getting confused, and I was in a high-low situation. I thought at a number of times that that was what was going to happen to me. So as close as I can be to saying suicide, that's what I would put in the mix to start off with. I was never at a point that I wished to, or a point of desperation, or in Kevin's point, actually taking the final step. Subsequently, over the last 10 or 11 years, I've run radio programs back home in Ireland and now one in the South Bay that hopes to break stigma, to challenge existing views of mental health and well-being, and to encourage direction to recovery. I don't have a direction to recovery. I have my own story. I have Kevin's story to go on. That touches me. My story touches other people. Hopefully, we get other people to talk about their routes to recovery. We all have a responsibility in bringing each of us to a recovery in a sense, and I don't mean that we have to walk around and knock on everyone's shoulders and saying, are you going to commit suicide here? I can help you. But we really have to be a community where we're caring about the people around us before they get to that point, so that we realise, well, perhaps there's something that's not going well for Johnny or Jimmy or Joan or whoever it might be, and saying, how are you? And when you say, how are you, you really turn on the listening mode, that you're actually listening to what they're saying. You switch off your own judgmental mental capacity and say, well, tell me how you are and let me hear how you feel. You don't have to have the answer for them. You may have some suggestion towards the end of the conversation. You may not. But first of all, listen. I can make many observations about the mental health services here, but I'm someone who's visiting on a long-term basis, and I wouldn't be rude enough to do that. But I can say that, just like the rest of the world, we're really coming to terms with how we can look after people rather than how we can manage the numbers. And I hope that you all realise the difference of attitude within that. But it's about people. Mental health isn't about getting the numbers down. Mental health is about looking after each individual. You have to do it in a collective way. My own experience back home in Ireland would have been that there are a number of routes to recovery, some of which require medical intervention and require medication. Well, medication is very much necessary, and more than a number of questions. I don't always see how there's a holistic approach to mental health and the well-being within that system, and it's just here, take the pill, take the pill, take the pill. There isn't that combination that Kevin is talking about. It's about getting out there and walking, perhaps giving you a little help.
Connecting help with people.
It's connecting with people and giving them a mode of learning. The biggest thing in development for me was the cognitive behavioral therapy, where they were giving you an opportunity to get back into an organized and positive way of thinking. It's a combination of things. It's not a simple thing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that perspective. Let's go to one of your emails. They say, how does the suicide hotline deal with the fear that by revealing one's suicide ideation, one will be vulnerable to compulsory treatment? So if somebody calls, how do you, guarantee that, it's okay, nobody's here to go find you and put some pills in your mouth?
That is a great question, and I'm so glad that whoever asked that question did, because this is something that I really want to communicate with the public about, which is that we do not want to hospitalize people. Like, the reason why we exist is that we want to prevent people from having to be put under what in California is called a 5150 or a 72-hour involuntary psychiatric hold. So our service is supposed to be an alternative to that. We do call emergency services for callers in a very, very small minority of cases. We get about 60,000 calls per year. Last year, we called services for 70 calls. So it's very, very rare that we do it. And the only time that we will call the police or in San Francisco Mobile Crisis, which is a mental health unit that will go to the scene of a psychiatric emergency. The only time that we will call either of those services is when somebody says, I am definitely going to attempt suicide within the next 24 hours. There's nothing that you can do to prevent me from doing that. And they just keep saying that over and over on the call, and they don't seem to change their mind. And often we also have callers who call in after initiating a suicide attempt, whether by overdose or some other means, and they're asking for our help. So that's also included in that 70 calls per year that we send services. I'd like to think that most of our callers will tell us the truth, but if you call and you say, oh, I'm not going to attempt suicide today, you can still express your feelings without the fear of us sending emergency services.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we have another email from Eric in San Francisco has a question. He says, does anybody know how many suicides per year are caused by jumping in front of BART trains or Caltrain? And is anyone proposing any kind of barriers there? Does anybody know about that, Dr. Friedman?
The issue of how many people, and I know that's been a problem recently. So we don't really know exactly how many people are die by running in front of a train. We know that not everybody does, and often they'll live with severe injuries. There are some efforts taking place to make things like to make it safer, to limit points of access that are frequently used. It's difficult for railroads because often there's an expanse. And so they're starting with work on the platforms and trying to put barriers up there as well. Other efforts around the world have included shrubbery for train tracks in general, thorny shrubbery, fences, lighting, all kinds of ways to help prevent suicide by limiting access means. But the actual numbers, because of the way the numbers are recorded, it's not right now possible to see how many have been due to railway. Mm-hmm.
Kevin Hines, do you have any idea about the Caltrain and BART deaths?
I don't know the numbers, but I will tell you that earlier this year, I believe it was February, I think, we did a press conference at BART location in San Francisco where several people spoke, including me, and we put up the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, a plethora of posters around the BART stations throughout, and they're still working on solving that issue, or at least lowering the rates. And like Donna said, it's not about the numbers; it's about the people and getting them some shared experience so they stay alive. But they are working on it, and I think what the good doctor said is accurate.
Dr. Friedman, Donegg was talking about community rather than,
right,
you know, as a form of prevention and talking to people and connecting with
right.
people and asking them how they are.
Right.
Do you think we
right.
don't have enough of that? And could that be one, you know, causing reason for, you know, all of these, not the mental health problems, of course, but just would connecting with people help? And what can we do?
Well, connecting with people can definitely help for a few reasons. First of all, we know that when people are in a state of wanting to die by suicide, they often feel they don't feel connection with others. They feel, if anything, that they're a burden and that if they're in their absence, that other people would be better off. Of course, that's a sign of illogical thinking because...
So can I just ask you in that point, because... You know, you hear that the person committing suicide is selfish. Oh, he or she is selfish. Look what they're going to cause their family and look what... So you're saying the exact opposite.
Right. They're just not thinking the way they would normally think. You know, we know that 90% of people who die by suicide have some type of mental health condition. that impairs their ability to think like they normally would. And often there's more than one. Sometimes there are substances involved. And so we look at them and they look the same, but their thinking is not the same. And that's part of how we say talk saves lives. Mm-hmm. Because when you imagine feeling that awful and not being able to talk about it, but when you open it up and you can talk to other people, they can maybe even, first of all, reach out to you, but also identify if you're struggling and could benefit from getting help and take you to get help. We don't expect people to be mental health professionals, but that sense of connection, that not having to keep it in and have it feel more explosive, and also compassion and respect. We do think these things, and you know, in conjunction with interventions for that moment, are really critical. And that's where you mentioned stigma before. Stigma hurts, and that's what we need to get rid of.
And again, the number to call and join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. If you or someone around you has had experience with attempt to commit suicide, we're also talking about the net that will be built under the Golden Gate Bridge to prevent suicides. 866-798-8255. Let's go to the phones again, and let's talk to Eve in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to comment that there is not a one-to-one correlation between the money spent on the barrier for the Golden Gate Bridge and the provision of mental health services. First of all, more than 50% of the people who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge were not in receiving any mental health services at all. They were in some sort of crisis that may or may not have had anything to do with mental health. Kevin Hines is a wonderful human being. People say he is bipolar. He is many, many other things. He was a football player. He's a warm person who likes babies and dogs. He is a whole other human being who struggles with bipolar disorder. Mental health and mental illness is a very painful thing to struggle with. Suicide is about pain, and there are many other kinds of pain. Mm-hmm. So when you have someone who has an episode of pain in their lives, that may be very time-limited, and it usually is. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the most effective thing you can do is to remove a lethal means that is in the person's environment. The most lethal means that is in the Bay Area is the Golden Gate Bridge. Once you have that out of the way, someone who has an impulse during a period of intense pain is not going to have the means available to them as handily as we have it right now, where you can take a bus or just park in a parking lot. So there isn't a one-to-one correlation at all.
Okay.
$76 million does not buy very much mental health care. Mm-hmm. The city and county of San Francisco spends $20 million a year just covering people who do not have health insurance. So $76 million might buy 2 years of mental health care at the most for people in San Francisco, but it would save the lives of 100 people.
Okay. Thank you so much for the call, Eve. Let's continue taking your calls at 866-798-TALK. From El Cerrito, let's talk to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Someone I know attempted suicide, and afterward tried to find a therapist to work with. And in talking to mental health professionals, was frequently told that the suicide attempt wasn't genuine, that it was simply a cry for help. And I'm wondering how your guests on the panel feel about that kind of a response, whether it's helpful or, in this case, it seemed to this friend of mine to be pretty dismissive, and so I was just wondering what reaction they had.
Okay,
I think that's a terrible reaction because you're invalidating that person's terrible pain, saying that what they just did was simply not what it was. And if they believe it was, if they feel that that's what they did, and in their heart of hearts, and they feel immense pain from it, invalidating that pain, in my opinion, is a terrible thing to do. Just like invalidating the pain of someone who says they have mental illness for the first time to the first person they tell, and they haven't told anyone before, and someone says, well, you know, you'll just get over it. It's just a phase. I mean, these are things that we deal with. To say that, you know, we talk about this as stigma all the time. Isn't it really discrimination? I mean, you know, we don't call racism stigma. We don't call bigotry stigma. Let's call this what it is. You know, when insurance companies didn't pay the same amounts that they did for physical health, for mental health, we have a big problem. That's why the mental health parity bill was so important. But even still, some insurance companies refused to pay those insurance claims out to the full degree at which they would a physical health problem. Rosalind Carter, for the First Lady Rosalind Carter, 60 years ago said that it shouldn't be health, it shouldn't be mental health, it should be all health under one roof, the same thing, because the brain connects to the rest of the body. The brain is the single most powerful organ in our body, and when things with the brain, like brain pain, occur and lead to suicide or suicide attempts or terrible depressions, you know, it should be one and the same. And that's something this country and the rest of the world needs to work towards.
Hmm. Courtney Brown, obviously you, your hotline is welcoming and you don't dismiss anybody like that. But have you heard that from some of your people who call in, that I tried talking to someone and they blew me off?
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I also hear from third-party callers who are concerned about other people in their life, and they say, oh, is this discussion of suicide or is this attempt that they made a, quote, legitimate attempt, or was it a cry for help? And there is this association with a cry for help being something that should be dismissed. But, I mean, to me, a cry for help is great. You know, it's some method of communication. I wish that they would use a means of communication that doesn't result in physical harm to themselves. But at least there is some sort of conversation happening about the pain that exists in them. I don't think there should be any sort of distinction between somebody whose desire to not exist anymore results in taking means against their own life, or somebody whose desire not to exist anymore is this internal just devastating experience that they go through every single day. No matter what, that shouldn't be something that any human being has to deal with, and we should treat each person who's dealing with that pain the same way, with compassion.
Kevin, this question is for you from an emailer who says, Kevin has mentioned having friends, family, faith, and a wife to rely on. What if someone is without such safety net resources? I'm currently in therapy and have a few people in my life, but still, as an unmarried senior, no dependents, living on a limited fixed income, saddled with depression and regrets about how life might have turned out differently, and with increasing concern about health and limited finances, the feeling of isolation continues to grow. While I have never made an attempt nor plans to carry it out, thoughts of suicide have grown over time. Worry about what the future holds. Who will be there for me to care for me? What can he do?
Well, to this individual, I'm saddened that you feel you don't have anyone in your life or not enough people in your life to help you with that kind of thing. I think that if you don't have an immediate family, a friend or a wife or even a husband for that matter, who is right near your side, right by your side, helping you heal, I think you have to search out and find people that can help you. For example, a resource for this individual, in my opinion, would be nostigmas.org. It's a place where you can get either free or low-income costing therapy. It's first of all, a website that allows you to get help no matter what your income is. It allows you to find hope and healing through people that will be around and available to you whenever you reach out to them. And they employ several top-notch therapists and psychopharmacologists, things of that nature, that reach out to people via the internet and other areas, via the phone, and have conversations with them and have therapy sessions, because they're trying to give them the hope they desire and low-income strategies for people in your position that need help but can't afford it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedman, speaking of the internet, you work with young people. So how can we reach out to young people before these issues even start and before it was too late? You know, Facebook, Instagram, the internet, that's where they are. What are you doing? What works?
Right. So I think you're right. You have to reach out to people where they are. And
for kids, it is the internet, it is social media, and there's lots of very positive and helpful information out there in those venues. So there are interventions such as Now Matters Now, which is at nowmattersnow.org, that helps teach people techniques and ways to make their lives better and to manage things like very strong emotions and to manage stressors. The internet is one place, but as Kevin says, the family, the home, whether you're reaching out to a social service agency, the elderly are often at high risk for the very reasons that were described by that email. And yet there are social agencies that will reach out to people and connect to people. Mm. It's the same for kids, having a place to go where you feel connected, having programs in school, having counseling in school makes a big difference. So it's about educating people the connection between their own mental health and well-being and their own behavior and what they can do to feel better and stay healthy.
We still have some lines open if you'd like to give us a call. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. We have another email that I want to go to. And the emailer, Salam, says they've had a death in the family. A very special and close person passed away. During this time, I've got the notion from people around me that it's my problem, I should keep it to myself or deal with it. That people have gone through similar experiences. It isn't acceptable to be sad or anxious or stressed in American culture. I've been looking for some kind of professional help, but I can't afford it. And I find myself in a strange space where I'm alone in the middle of a large crisis. The Bay Area, very diverse, many cultures, immigrant communities, people coming from cultures where grieving is very, you know, it's open and people grieve in different ways. And this person is told, it's your problem, deal with it. Courtney Brown, what do you tell somebody like that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, thank you so much for reaching out, Salam. I would say that isolation is really, really common. And I think that a lot of people in the Bay Area feel isolated in a crowd and feel like they can't really express what's going on inside.
You have to be happy all the time.
Yeah,
you have to be joyful and happy and smiling. Exactly.
There's this need to, if you're going to be part of the community, you have to be a positive part of the community, and that grieving and suffering isn't something that you can have out there. And I do think that when, hopefully, if you express yourself enough, you will find somebody else who's sharing the same thing. And I know that, I mean, this, I'm like a broken record with this. You can call us, and we would definitely be happy to talk to you
and validate
your feelings.
Can you give out that number, please?
Sure. Our phone number is 415-781-0500. 415-781-0500. We have translation services if somebody would like to call in a different language. And even though we don't always share the same cultural background that our callers are coming from, we try to be as open as possible. And whatever your experience of the world is and whatever you're going through, we are open to hearing about and we think is valid and worth space.
And let's go to another call. Let's go to... Oh, Dr. Yes. Friedman, yes. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but there are often grief and bereavement groups. Mm-hmm. There's usually no fee for them. Sometimes there's a fee. But if you look on the web, there are groups for people who've lost people to all kinds of things, and those groups can be very helpful. And it does help to be among people who are experiencing what you've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Again, the number is 866-798-TALK. We do have a line open. Let's go to Erica. Welcome to your call.
Thank you very much. I just have so many things I want to say just all over the place. Thank you for Salam for that last call. We've definitely experienced that when we lost our daughter. My husband John called earlier. She was 17. She was not diagnosed properly by all the doctors she had seen. She had attachment disorder. She was in an orphanage until the age of 15 months, but she was able to cover it up so well and put on that smiling face and as an adoptee wanting to just you know, be worthy of all the love that she was given, even though she knew that she was the greatest gift we'd ever received in our lives, because she had a hole inside of her that she couldn't believe that. We are so materialistic in this culture. We look at people like, what do you do? Where did you go to school? Rather than who you are as a person. What is your spirit? What is your heart? Not how much money do you make? What do you do for a living? This is a big reason for the unhappiness out there. And there are countless car accidents that are covered up suicide. Some people are...
Thank you, Erica. I'm so sorry to have to cut you off, but we are at the end of the show. Thank you so much for that call, and thank you to everybody who's called in, and we're sorry if we could not get to your call. And thank you to our guests, Kevin Hines, thank you so much, Dr. Jill Friedman from New York, Courtney Brown. That number, again, the Suicide Hotline in San Francisco, 415-781-0500. Thank you all for being here today. And if you need help, seek it. It is here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It really is.
All right. All right. Thank you all for being
you.
With us.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
This has been Your Call. We will be back tomorrow. So hope you will too. I'm Hannah Baba sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thank you so much. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Marion Nessel about her new book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Nessel says soda companies have been employing marketing, public relations, and lobbying to protect their profits at the expense of public health. But health advocacy has become the single greatest threat to soda industry profits. So how are people organizing against Big Soda? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Renee Kemp. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.